One of the things I always find striking when we have this kind of cold and snowy weather, particularly on the occasions when the night comes and things are just chilly and the air is cooling down, and then when the next morning comes, there's been a snowfall in the night and everything is covered in snow, or at least has is edged with snow. But it emphasizes so clearly that quality of, you can live in a place and have very familiar shapes and sights around you, or the shape of the buildings or the trees or the hills, and the eye gets used to particular forms, even changing through the clear days and rainy days and times of night and day and twilight, and we become unconscious of the familiarity, the kind of conditioning that the mind has towards those particular patterns. And then when there's a snowfall, or even just with a very sharp frost, but particularly with the snow, suddenly in the space of a night or a few hours, every horizontal surface is etched with that white edge, and then the world is transformed, isn't it? It's always impactful. At least I find it so. How much the world changes. Suddenly, every edge is marked in white. Every horizontal or horizontal-ish line is edged in white, and the whole world is drawn in a different way. And so those trees, those roof lines, those edges, those nondescript things that don't really catch our attention, the railings or even the portalettes, the garbage cans, things that just don't really normally catch our attention, suddenly there they are, edged with this sort of perfect white frosting, each line carefully covered with a array of ice crystals. The whole world has changed. The whole world is transformed, and it's shocking, isn't it? Kind of marvelous, wonderful how totally different the world can be just with that change, just with suddenly every line being edged in white. Suddenly it's all different. There's a whole other world. And even though we see it go through so many changes of day and night and spring and summer, then there's something in the heart that shifts. Oh, I didn't realize, I forgot it could be this different. I forgot that the world could change this much, that it could be seen in such a radically altered way. Oh, in this, what makes me think of this is in this chant we did this evening, the Dhammacakka Sutta. This is the account of the Buddha's first teaching to the five companions that he had before his enlightenment, the group of five bhikkhus, and it's the exposition of the middle way and the Four Noble Truths. And so in the course of this teaching, as he's explaining these radical insights, for the first time spelling out what it is that he's understood with his enlightenment, the way that he followed to realization. This is the first time that he had distilled his understanding into these words. So it was a very impactful exchange. And then during the course of the teaching, then even though it was such the Buddha was so fully liberated and was explaining this and putting this into words, to people who were experienced meditators, only one of them actually really understood what he was saying. as it says in the sutta, the discourse, as the Buddha was teaching, and as he finished explaining how there was an insight into the Four Noble Truths, the truth of dukkha, dissatisfaction, its cause being tanha, self-centered desire, craving, the fact that it could end, that there was not an absolute reality, not a kind of necessary part of the experience of living, and dukkha could cease, and the way to bring dukkha to its end, the Eightfold Path. As he explained this, and then said that, pointed out that, as long as he didn't understand these Four Noble Truths, dukkha, samudaya, nirodha, magga, suffering, origin, cessation, and path, then he never could claim that he was fully liberated, fully enlightened. But as soon as he fully understood, fully knew these four qualities, dukkha, samudaya, nirodha, magga, then he was able to acknowledge, to claim that his enlightenment was complete. And also in a different place he said, it's because of not understanding four things that you and I and all other beings have had to travel and trudge around the long, long round of lives, births and lives and deaths and rebirths and redeaths. And those four things are the four noble truths: suffering, origin, cessation, and path. So as he explained this, then one of the five, Kandanya, who, according to the stories, was the elder or the sort of the leader of the group, Kandanya was the only one who understood. And so, as it says in the sutta, there's also a bit of a play on words at this point in the discourse, because the word for this teaching is called the turning of the wheel, the Dhammacakka, turning of the wheel of truth, setting in motion of the wheel of truth, Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta. And Dhammacakka means the wheel of truth or the wheel of Dhamma. And the word for wheel, chakka, is very similar to the word for eye, which is chakku. Obviously, they're kind of related, the eye being sort of round, and the iris and the pupil being like a wheel-like image in the eye. So chakku is the word for eye, chakka the word for wheel. So it's said in the sutta that at that point, when the Buddha finished his explanation, then the eye of Dhamma opened or arose in Kandanya, Dhamma Chakum Udapadi. The eye of Dhamma arose. And so it was at that point that suddenly, just like the snow appearing on all of the roots and branches and edges of the pebbles on the road, then Kandanya's vision changed. Everything changed. There was a shift in his world. This is what the eye of Dhamma means. It's like suddenly the world is seen in a radically different way. And it's not the same world as it was before. There's a shift, a transformation. And it's even more complete or radical and compelling than waking up and finding everything edged in white. It's of a whole different order, but it carries that same aura of utter transformation. And it's also interesting that when the Buddha realized this, that Kandanya had understood, then, as it says at the end of the discourse, the Buddha calls out, "Anyasi vatabo Kandanyo." Anyasi vatabo kandanyoti. Kandanya understands. Kandanya understands. And then they have another little word play, along with Dhammacakka and Dhammacakku. You have, along with the name Kandanya, was the monk's name, and then Anya is the word for to understand or to know. And so it says, because the Buddha called out in this kind of exclamation of excitement and enthusiasm and delight that somebody had understood what he was saying. Anyasi vatabo kondanyo. My friend, Kondanya understands. Then it says, from that time on, he was known as Anya Kondanya, Kondanya who understands. And I remember there was a monk in England, in our community at Chithurst, as the Ajahn Sumedho produced Anagarikas and novices. He in those days he didn't do ordinations himself, so he had this elder monk in London, Dr. Saratiso, did the ordinations for us, and he was naming Ajahn Sumedho's students after the first five disciples. So the first one was Kondanya, and he had actually been he was a Sri Lankan man who'd been a car mechanic and a student of Dr. Saratisa for years and years, and so he'd been kind of working on him for a long time before he decided to go forth into the monastic life. And so Dr. Saratisa would habitually refer to him as Kondanya, not yet Anya. So the name and its connotations, its resonances linger on over many, many centuries. Anya Kondanya, Kondanya who understands. So then this is quite a dramatic moment, quite a marvelous moment, the first transmitting of the Dhamma, the moment when the insight into truth was actually transmitted, conveyed from the newly awakened Buddha to the first one who understood. So this was a momentous occasion, and the first teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And so when we think about that kind of insight, you know, what transforms the world, what is this sort of earth-shattering, earthquake-inducing, as it was, you know, the earth shook at that time. What was the insight that shakes the earth and is so momentous that would make the Buddha cry out, Kondanya understands? And as often is the case in the Pali literature, in the Theravada world, you know, things are very understated. It's not a very grandiloquent tradition. And so when the Buddha describes what the insight was that arose in Kondanya, when the eye of Dhamma opened, what did he see? What did he realize? It's very, very simple, you know, disarmingly simple, excruciatingly simple. Because all that Kondanya saw was Yankinchi Samudaya Dhammang Sabantang Niroda Dhammanti. Whatever is of the nature to arise, that is also of the nature to cease. Whatever is of the nature to arise, that is of the nature to cease. So that's the earth-shattering, you know, all-consuming, world-changing insight. Whatever goes up must come down. You think, well, big deal. You know, I figured that out when I was 3 years old. You know, what goes up must come down. Is that it? Is that the amazing, incredible thing? Doesn't seem like very much. Doesn't seem like anything special at all. How can that really change the world? Surely there must be more to it than that. Similarly, as when you think of the enlightenment of a Buddha, and here's the transforming of a life to be completely in tune with ultimate reality and to awaken to the fundamental nature of thing and of all things, and to also develop an astonishing range of powers and capacities, insights. Yes, similarly, it seems like an amazing, incredible thing. And then the Buddha says, that insight is just based on suffering, origin, cessation, and path. It's just, those are the only things you need to understand. It's those four words. What they imply, that's all it takes. All you have to do is understand dukkha, samudaya, nirodha, magga, and then you can be a Buddha. Easy. not complicated. So for the eye of Dhamma to open, that's all we need to do, is to see that everything that arises, everything subject to arising, is subject to cessation. It's so simple, isn't it? That's why it's excruciatingly simple, because it seems obvious to the thinking mind, to the conceptual mind, but there the fact is that also recognizing that knowing the idea, having the formula, doesn't actually get you through the gate. You know, you have the password, but somehow the door isn't opening. It's like, hey, so I've got all the right words here. You know, I can even recite them in Pali. How come the door is still locked? How come I can't get through? So obviously, it's not just an intellectual understanding of, just as with Buddhahood, requires more than just knowing the words suffering, origin, cessation, and path. There's a whole different order of knowing, and so that transformation of the heart is to do with, and what really liberates, what enabled Kandanya, his eye to open to the Dhamma, for the Dhamma eye to open, to him to enter the stream, which is another way of describing it, is that intuition in the heart of what that implies, letting that knowledge, that insight, you know, soak into every dimension of our experience, so that if we really know that everything that is of the nature to arise is of the nature to cease, if we really let that in to the heart, let that inform the way we see and we feel and we relate to our own inner world and the world around us, then it's that allowing it in and intuiting, knowing the implications of that. That's the thing. That's the element that transforms the world, that changes everything. That's what enables us to really see the world of Dhamma rather than the world of my memories or my habits, my preferences, my fears, my hopes, my opinions, my ideas, where we go from my world to the world of Dhamma. So that transforming, that entering of the stream, or the opening of the Dhamma eye, seeing all that arises passes away, that's described as functioning in three particular areas, or three particular obstructions that are seen through, that we don't, you know, normally see through, that seem solid and kind of immovable, ordinary aspects of reality. So the first is that of identification with the body and the personality, and so that developing this quality of insight, looking at the quality of change or transiency or uncertainty, just in relationship to the feeling of ourself, me as a person, this body, this personality, this identity. So it's allowing that recognition of change to be the framework in which we regard ourselves. You know, thinking of ourselves as a woman or as a man, as old or as young, having a nationality, having an age, having a birthday, a social security number, a name, having a kind of personal history, or a size, if we think we're too thin or too fat or too short or too tall, or however we might frame our own our own body or our own personality, being introvert and extrovert, being clever, being stupid, being scientific, being artistic, being a reclusive type, being gregarious type, being efficient or being confused, however it might be, all of those I am statements and perceptions. This is what this is referring to, just to see these are fundamentally uncertain, unstable aspects of nature. They arise, they cease. The body was born, it grows up, does its thing, fades away and dies. Aspects of the personality, different moods and feelings, thoughts. So that developing this insight to cut through personality view, sakaya ditti, the identification with body and mind, and the particularly the I feeling, is taking this insight into anicca, arising and ceasing, uncertainty and changing, and using that as the lens through which we examine me and my world, to consider that. And so we, as we hold that up, we hold that lens up, and we look at our life through that that means. It starts to reveal those things about ourselves that we tend to regard as being inarguable. Of course I'm a man, or of course I'm English, or yeah, I am. I have an age. I was born so many years ago. I have a family. I have a place where I live. These are ordinary, natural, inarguable truths. But then when we look closer, we start to examine that. We see how fabricated and dependent those kind of judgments and perceptions are. They have meaning or value because of our conditioning or because of the way that society holds them. But you say, I'm 49 years old. Well, that's only has any meaning because of living on planet Earth and the Earth spinning, rotating around the sun at a certain periodicity. And that, you know, you choose to measure or create time in that way. But there's actually, in ultimate truth, no such thing as years. We create that. That's a human agreement to talk in terms of laps around the sun. It's a convenient usage that we can kind of measure each other with, but it has no absolute meaning. If we lived on a different planet, if we were all, you know, out on Saturn or Jupiter, then we'd all be a lot younger, wouldn't we? Jodi Pala would be only about 4.5, and Dhammadasa would be 3. Yeah, it changes it, doesn't it? If we lived on Mercury, of course, we'd all be, you know, 110, 315. Even thinking of it makes us feel older. It's just a convenient way of arranging things. There's no absolute substance there. So wherever it is in our life, maybe think, well, age is, you know, easy to see, no problem. You know, that's no big deal. But, you know, I am a human being. I am an introvert. You know, I am someone who has this particular character or these particular problems. That's true. That's real. So that what we're doing with developing this insight, or what the way to see the world transformed, to see the world of Dhamma rather than my world, and, you know, the limitations of that conditioning, is to challenge those assumptions, to challenge those absolutely unremarkable given realities, and to say, well, is that so? Is it so that I'm a man? Is it so that I'm a human being? Is it so that I have an age or I have a family? Is that really an absolute fact? How does anybody have anything? How do we own anything? What is that? What is owning? owning a mind, owning a body, owning a personality, owning a personal history. What is that? We begin to see when we look at it in that way how much is just dependent on memory, on perception. And when the memory goes, you know, or the perceptions are not there, then what sustains it? What makes that reality? You know, when we have some kind of mental aberration, we suddenly have our mind goes blank. We suddenly can't remember, you know, the name of our best friend, or even, you know, or if we have some kind of illness or aging with Alzheimer's disease, these kind of conditions, the memory's gone. We might be able to be quite sort of alert and functional in the present, but maybe all those memories have vanished. We don't even know we can't even remember our own life. We can't remember the people around us. I remember one friend of ours talking about her relationship with her mother, which had been very sort of tense and difficult throughout her life. And in the last year or two of her mother's life, her memory went completely. And even though she'd had this sort of tense and difficult relationship, I guess her opinion was that her mother had got all of her negativity out of her system while she was fully conscious and active. when she lost her capacity to remember and to kind of hold things together in that normal, you know, familiar functioning way, she didn't have much negativity left in her because she'd spent her whole life expressing it and never holding anything back, and so she became very sweet, whereas she'd always been sort of a kind of caustic and critical, complaining type. That all seemed to fall away in the last couple of years, and she said there were these extraordinary moments where her mother would look at her and say, "You're very kind to me. I have a daughter. She'd like you." Not realizing that that was her daughter that she was talking to. But being able to simply appreciate that kindness in the present moment, but not being able to piece together the perceptions, the familiarity. Oh, this is my daughter, I am this person, this is my character, this is my life. It can fall away. And if it falls away, what is it that's sustaining it? What sustains that reality? Nothing does, because there's no solidity there. There's nothing substantial there. So then to look at the other dimensions of this, so along with personality view, then the another of the obstructions is that of Silapata Paramasa, which is traditionally translated as something like attachment to rites and rituals, but more broadly and more realistically, it's the rites and rituals of human society, human convention. So it's just as we, Sakaya Ditti or personality view is the identification or the endowing of the body and our personal world with solidity, then this is endowing the world around us and social conventions and customs and forms with equal meaning and solidity. So it's the conventions of of name or of something having value or worth, saying, you know, this is a quality that has intrinsic meaning and value. So those would be such things as religious conventions. So saying, recognizing there isn't actually any such thing as Buddhism or as monastic life, or there isn't anything really such thing as nationality or race. These are conventions that are gathered together. There are human agreements that are held in place by enough of us thinking about it and believing it and going along with it. If we all change it, if we all decide to shift those agreements, then they shift. Like when we change the clocks, you know, end of the month, end of March, I think last Sunday in March, suddenly everyone on the Pacific Coast, at least in North America, we change our clocks. And it's kind of interesting in the US, because different states have different systems for this, and so you can find all kinds of interesting scrambles of dating and timing systems when you go from one state to another. And as Tanjali Pala often points out, Indiana is still 1949 in Indiana. Is that right?
57,
excuse me. It's always 1957 in Indiana, because they never change their clocks. And but isn't that interesting? Suddenly we all agree, okay, today has an extra hour, or today has an hour less, and at 2 o'clock in the morning the clock stands still, or at 2 o'clock in the morning an hour vanishes and it goes from being two to being three, just instantaneously, just because of an agreement. We create a convention and then we all go along with it. Or when they put the gas prices up or down, you know, you can't sort of go to a gas station and say, well, last week you said it was only $1.89 and now you're saying it's $2.30. I choose the smaller number, thank you very much. No, they choose a number and then we choose to hand over those amounts of agreed upon credit units called money that match that. Money itself is just an agreement that the value of it goes up or goes down, what it can buy, what it can't buy, it changes according to human agreements. What happens in the stock market? You know, talk about conventional realities. The value of stocks, you know, the whole thing is completely sort of constructed out of the human mind. There's just ones and zeros changing on computers somewhere off in cyberspace that says this stock's just gone through the roof, or this one's just plummeted and it's now worth nothing. This morning you were worth $100,000 and now those stocks have collapsed so that you're only worth 15. What happened? It's just a conventionally ascribed value. The humans agree to say this has this particular potency, and you go along with the agreement and there it is. But the whole thing is just smoke and mirrors. There's actually no thing there. It's just we agree to call it that, and that's what it is. It's like, I remember vividly a phrase of Kurt Vonnegut's talking about money being devalued. He says, one minute you're using it you're piling it up in the bank and it's the embodiment of your worth and substance, and the next day you're using it to line the bottom of your birdcage. The money is just bits of paper. It's become valueless, and so you might as well just put it in the birdcage so that the parrot can poop on it, because it's not used. You can't take it into a shop and buy anything with it anymore. The government just said currency is is devalued, although this currency is no longer valid, and it's worthless. It's just bits of paper. That's all. So the quality of attachment to convention, the seeing through this eye of Dhamma, seeing through this same lens into the conventions that we believe in, conventions of where we are in society, that I'm an important person because I've got a doctorate, I'm an MD or a PhD, or I'm a parent, or I'm an experienced meditator. I've been a monk for 27, 28 years. What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. What is a monk? What is a layperson? These are conventions that are just conjured up out of nothing. They're human agreements. But you buy into that system and you give it value. And you say, oh, wow, you've been a monk for how long? Wow, that's amazing. You go to some other society and they say, in some other culture, and they go, monk? What is monk? Doesn't have any meaning. Has no value. There's no weight to it. So, what does it mean? So we're looking at that quality of arising, ceasing, that these conventions, these forms, that they're given value. They come into being because of the way we think, and then they dissolve. They're not stable, not dependent, not solid. They are empty. There is no thing there. From their own side, they have no substance. And so that when we see that, then it changes the way that we relate to those conventions that we live with. And we function in the world, and we don't just kind of drive into a gas station and say, money doesn't exist. They'll say, thank you very much, but until you swipe your card, you can't you can't get the liquid out of the pipe. So you can believe what you like, but you're not getting the gas. You know, you have to go along with the conventions of, and you know, here in a monastery, you know, this is where the monastics live, this is where the lay people live, this is where we sit, you know. Came along one evening and suddenly found, you know, Lee sitting in my seat here at the front. I think, I wouldn't think, he's had an insight into conventional reality. I think he's losing his marbles. We follow along with convention, but we see through the apparently substantial nature of it. That's what we mean by letting go of convention, or letting go of identification. It's not trying to discard it or defying it, just flouting it. That's actually still buying into it. Saying you're not attached to convention, therefore you disregard it or cast it away or contravene it. A true understanding or true letting go of convention is that where we are able to live in accord with it, but without any confusion about it. We know that, you know, that money doesn't really exist, that gender doesn't really exist, nationality doesn't really exist. You know, age and status and all of these different qualities that the world, the kind of the group mind creates and ascribes. So we're able to see that these are unstable, impermanent, uncertain fabrications, but yet in the same breath able to function with them and to work in accord with that. And the third of the obstructions, the third of the fetters that stand in the way of that, that obscure the eye of Dhamma, that cloud the eye of Dhamma, the Dhamma Chakku, is that of doubt, vichikicca. And this isn't just doubt about what to have for breakfast or whether you should, you know, change your sitting posture because your knee is aching. It's doubt about what is the path and what is not the path is the essential meaning of doubt here. What is the way? What is not the way? Oh, one of the ways that, although the most helpful method of working with doubt and the mind caught in confusion about how we should cultivate, how we should practice, how we should guide our lives and develop the meditation, what we should do, how we should work with the mind. When the mind is caught in doubt, it's so compelling, entrancing, isn't it, that the mind, we get drawn into trying to think our way to some sort of finality, some kind of completeness. We're not sure about what to do, what's the right thing. And even if it's not doubt about what's the path or not the path, even mundane doubts, you know, this is still exactly the same way that it works. What should I do? What's the right thing for me to do? Yeah. Should I go forward? Should I hold back? Should I go left? Should I go right? Should I speak up? Should I keep quiet? What should I do? The mind gets caught, and we try to think our way to a conclusion. We try to use reason and gathering support from one side or another internally or externally, to come to a conclusion, to come to a sense of certainty. We don't want to be uncertain. To be uncertain is an uncomfortable, difficult feeling. But as Voltaire said, probably in French, well, pretty sure in French, uncertainty, doubt may be an uncomfortable condition, but certainty is ridiculous. Doubt may be an uncomfortable condition, but certainty is ridiculous. But even though it's ridiculous, we love it. We want to be sure this is the right thing. This is good, that's bad, this is right, that's wrong. Something in us is comforted by that. But the best way to deal with doubt, to work with doubt, when the mind is caught in it and compulsively trying to arrive at certainty and stability, security by thinking, is to recognize exactly this quality of arising and ceasing in the feeling of doubt. So this is really a crucial element of meditation practice, and particularly because in the West we tend to be so heavily conditioned to buying into our thoughts, believing in our thoughts, is to, when you see the mind getting caught into a doubt spin, going round and round, what should I do, what's the right thing, what's good, is to consciously withdraw the attention from the content of the doubt, what the question is, and just to recognize that even though it might be a really, really important and significant problem that should be worried about, to actually lay the content of the question aside and recognize that this is a doubt that's arisen. This is a question that's come into being. And whether or not it's demanding to be answered, right now, what you can know for sure is that this is a feeling of doubt that has arisen. There's a samudaya, it has come into being. And then you can watch it and observe it, be with that feeling of not knowing, standing in front of the doors, thinking, should I go left or should I go right? Left door or right door? Which is the correct door? Left door, right door? Or maybe there's a third one. Left door, middle door, right door? Which one is the right door? Just knowing that feeling of perplexity, uncertainty, having seen it arisen and then watching it fade away, that you can't sustain that quality of doubt, of not knowing, of perplexity all the time. Like any other feeling, it comes into being, it does its thing, and then it fades away. Maybe it only fades away momentarily and then it's born again, it rises again. But like every other feeling, it has to follow that pattern. Samudaya dhammang sabantang nirodha dhammanti. Having come into being, then it nirodhas, it ceases, it fades away. That's its nature. And in that arising and ceasing, it's a complete thing. When we absorb into a doubt, then it's telling us we're incomplete. We need our answer to complete us. We need extra piece. We need to find the missing piece that will complete the circle. And so when the mind is in a state of doubt, then it's begging, demanding, pleading to be completed. I need the answer. I need to know. I need to be sure. I need to understand. I need to find out. I need to know.
I need to. I gotta.
And it's this kind of whining, whimpering, begging a feeling within us. And we can buy into that and then look desperately for the missing piece to find the bit that's going to complete us and make us whole. And we love to do that. You know, it's the habit, is we fill up that feeling of lack with a belief or a hope or a fear or something. But in this practice that I'm describing, and using the eye of Dhamma, developing the eye of Dhamma, is to see through the lens of arising and ceasing, of anicca, that regardless of how loudly and convincingly that doubt begs to be completed and have its answer, to make it whole, to have its, you know, the wedge put into place that'll provide the missing piece, to step back from it, just to take that step back that says, well, this is a good question. The answer is not known. But in this moment, this is a feeling that has arisen, and this feeling is a whole thing. There's nothing missing. Even though it's saying to me there's something missing, it's actually, there isn't anything missing. This feeling of doubt has arisen, it feels like this, it's come into being, and then it fades away, it arises, it ceases, it's perfect, it's complete, it's a whole thing. It's a perfect sankhara. It arises, it ceases. Nothing is missing. Regardless of what the content is proclaiming, the actuality is that there is nothing missing. It arises, it ceases, it's perfect. It comes into being, it dissolves, it ceases. That's it. End of story. So when we step back from a doubt, and we look at it in that way, then we're allowing more space around it. We're seeing that the universe has got more factors in it than just these sort of two possibilities that the mind has been creating. This is right, that's wrong. Which is one? Which one is it? We're able to open the heart to apprehend the whole situation, all the dimensions of our life in a very different way. And that way of recognizing that all that arises ceases, everything that comes into being dissolves. We begin to see that is the fail-safe manner of understanding, that if everything is seen through that lens, everything is seen through that eye, then fundamentally, yeah, that is the path. That seeing that no sankhara, no form is fundamentally stable or solid or dependable, that seeing is the way. That knowing, because that is like a creating a fundamental letting go, a fundamental non-attachment, non-identification with the world of fabrications, with the world of formations, as like a creating that basic relinquishment, seeing truly and completely that everything arises and ceases. Therefore, nothing is worth running away from, and nothing is worth chasing after, because it's going to cease. No need to run away, because it's going to cease. No need to chase after it, because it's going to cease. So there's an opening, an attunement to that basic ease of Dhamma, of seeing the truth of things. There's that the habit of agitation, of continually fretting, hankering and fretting for the world, as it's said, chasing after the pleasant, running away from the painful, that's cut, that's severed. As the Buddha uses these kind of analogies for this change, this breakthrough, like a radically changing the way in which we see the world, and saying that, you know, from that point on, then enlightenment, liberation is guaranteed. There's no turning back. Because from that point, you know, once the Dhamma has really been seen in that way, you can't unsee it. It's like once you've learned how to ride a bicycle, you can't unlearn it. Once you've seen a puzzle, you know, one of those sort of drawings where you're... Say the, you know, the Dalmatian is first of all, the picture looks like a bunch of black and white dots, and suddenly you see it's a Dalmatian dog walking through the patches of sunlight and shade. And once you've seen the Dalmatian, you can't unsee the Dalmatian. It's always going to be there. So this is a radical change. That's what happened in the heart of Venerable Kundanya. That irreversible change, that breakthrough occurred. And as the Buddha said, if you compare there's this whole section of the Sanyutta Nikaya called the breakthrough. And there's about 13 different suttas, and the Buddha uses different images in each one, but they all carry the same kind of message, where he scrapes the ground and picks up a little bit of dirt under his fingernail and says, "What do you think, bhikkhus? What is greater, the amount of earth under my fingernail, or the size of the great earth, the planet itself?" And he says, "Well, venerable sir, the amount of dirt under your fingernail is extremely small, but the size of the planet, of the great earth, is very, very large." And the Buddha said, so too, the suffering that you can expect to experience, a being can expect to experience going through birth and death, is compared to the, prior to making the breakthrough, is like comparable to the size of the whole planet. What they can expect to experience once the breakthrough has been made is comparable to the earth I have under my fingernail. It is insignificant. It is not inconsequential. It is not comparable in any way. And so, similarly, these kind of analogies of deeply encouraging one to make the breakthrough, to allow that insight to fully flourish, so that the heart genuinely, truly knows, it sees everything in this same way, sees that this. This world of Dhamma is the basic reality, and that the impressions of habit, my world, my past, my future, my likes, my dislikes, my judgments, these are ephemeral, insubstantial. They're not trustworthy. They have no fundamental substance or value. And when they're seen through, when they're let go of, when they're transient, empty nature is understood, then there's this change of heart. There's this great relief, and peacefulness, joyfulness, is opens up to us, and it's a different world. It's the world of Dhamma. So I offer these words for consideration this evening.